Forget how powerful our words are, and sometimes we need to be reminded that the words we say are not empty, they're not idle, they're not just fluff. We say a lot of things, sometimes we mean it, sometimes we don't, but there's real power in words. There are power in ideas. And I want to talk about today something else that there's a lot of power in that sometimes we forget about, that God talks about. I was going to mention to you, unfortunately, this is one of those weeks where the projector is not working. So last week you got to see, and this week you won't. But hopefully I'll go slow enough you can record it if you'd like. But we're going to talk a bit about the power of unity. And in Proverbs chapter 30, there is, from verse 24 to 27, talks about four things that are little on the earth, but exceedingly wise. Now, one of them, he talks about ants, and he talks about the rock badgers and some others. But the one I want to focus on are the locusts in verse 27. He says, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. So locusts who can sometimes come down and wipe out, a whole crop. They descend upon a crop, wipe it out, and all of a sudden, hundreds or thousands of people won't be able to eat, and they'll be, suffering hunger because of these little bugs that by themselves, we can step on and stomp and, squish them. But together, they have a power that we can't stop. We can't, get up and, find something to keep them away. I mean, we have trouble. Sometimes the little bugs in our houses, we sometimes, my daughter last week or something was like, I think we got ants coming in the building again. Yeah, that happens. And unfortunately we're built on a piece of land that has a lot of ants on it. So the ants sometimes come running in. But we can't stop them. We seal up as good as we can, but still we can't stop the little bugs. But together those bugs can do a lot. They're very powerful when they're all working together in unity. And obviously, God isn't that interested in the bugs or the rock badgers or the ants in terms of the wisdom for us. There are principles at work in all of those things. And there's something here about the locusts. It tells us they have no king. There's nobody leading them, and yet they all work together in their ranks, coming, all together, they're not hit and miss sporadically, so where they can't be effective. They're all working together without something telling them and leading them. Well, one of the principles that I think about that lesson is that we're not locusts. God gave us kings, Him being the great King. We're not locusts who advance together and walk in unity without anybody guiding us, without anybody leading us. We don't do that. It's a principle of unity and of working together and of teamwork that we should learn. But the reality is we're sheep, as God has told us, and we need somebody to guide us. We need somebody to help us. We need somebody to tell us, we need to stay together. We need to work together in order to be powerful, in order to be stronger. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verses 1 through 4, we just went through this in our midweek classes. After Paul has spent the first three chapters there of Ephesians talking about all the blessings we have because of Christ, he turns and begins to talk about how we ought to react then. Because of every blessing we have stored up for us in the heavenly places, he says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. I beseech you. I am urging you, he's saying. You need to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. You need to walk in a way that lives up to what you've been given and the blessings that have been laid aside for you. You need to take that into account. What has God done for you? What has He given you? And wow, what does He want you to do? And He says, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another in love. Now, first off, he mentions a couple of things, some basic principles. Lowliness, basically the idea of humbleness, not considering ourselves better than others. Second, he mentions gentleness, of not being harsh and rigid and difficult, but being gentle. And then he mentions long-suffering, or the idea of patience. You know, we might want to be doing something together. We might be trying to get everybody together. But it's hard to get a lot of people mobilized to work together in a very short period of time. Sometimes you got to be patient to bring everybody on board and get everybody working together. But he says we bring all of these things and bearing with one another in love. There's the clue that even though we're all Christians and he's writing to Christians who have all of these blessings, we still have to bear with one another because we haven't been perfected. We haven't been, you know, Christ-like in all of our attitudes and all of our actions and of all of our speech. And so we still have to bear with each other. We still have to forgive one another. We still have to, if we're going to do what he's urging here, which is the next thing, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit. And so he's beseeching us, he's urging us to walk in this way that's worthy of the calling which we've been called, and being humble and gentle and patient and forgiving and bearing with one another so that we can put out effort to keep the unity of the Spirit. See, God has unity. The very last part we'll come to in this lesson this morning will be God talking about unity again. But in that meantime, talk about some other things. But he says, God has unity. He's urging us to partake in his unity, to be a part of, to walk in it. He already has it. We need to become a part of it, and we need to spread it. And he says, but we need these other things, humbleness, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, and then we need the endeavoring. That's the effort. You know, growing up, every kid sometimes would like to cut corners to get the jobs done that they're, and the chores they're asked to do. They'd like to get them done very quickly so they could get out and have fun. Because that's their goal. Goal in life when you're a kid is, gotta have fun. When can I have fun? Are we there yet? Or is fun ready to start? You know? You're going on vacation, you know, taking that drive. Are we there yet? When's the fun gonna start? Well, sometimes you have to endeavor in the chores before you get a chance to do the fun part. And one of the principles that every kid has to learn is, okay, you know, I told you to go clean your room and you took everything and you slid it under the bed so it looks invisible to the eye walking into the room. Well, it wasn't endeavoring to do the work. And therefore, we get to pull it all back out and try again. This time, endeavoring to put it all away in its proper places. Now, I remember I was that kid. My room was a mess, and my parents were actually pretty easy on me. But if they ever did come down occasionally, or I would, you know, slide it under the bed if I could get away with it. Probably did a couple times. Most of the time, not. You know, pull it all back out. You know, put it away now. Oh, I'd be forever. I can't get to it. I'll never be able to go outside and play with my friends. They're all playing hide and seek right now. I'm going to miss it all. I remember the drama. I've heard the drama. I've lived the drama, both in my own, as a child growing up and in, you know, parent, hearing those things. And every parent, you recognize it. You see it. It's all, because every kid in that sense is the same. They want it. How quickly can you get it out of the way to go do the things I want to do? But learning to endeavor, learning to put the effort in to do something well is something that we all have to learn. And the reality is, that is exactly what, as Christians, we need to learn to do the exact same thing. If we want unity, we talk about unity, and we go, oh, you know, boy, we're not united, we're not together, we're not, but what are you doing for it? It's not enough to say, oh, it's great to have, I'd love to have it, but I'm not going to put out any effort for it. Because every time I put out the effort, you know, somebody hurts me. That's probably where that bearing with one another work comes into place. That's probably where that patience works out. That's why he said those things. Because it isn't easy. And it takes all of us. It takes everybody doing their part. That's why, you know, as we get into verse 16 of chapter 4 there, everybody doing their part causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. All of that whole chapter is really talking about the idea of working together, of having teamwork. And that's why I said we're not locusts, because we need to be endeavoring. See, locusts don't work at it. Locusts do it because that's the way they've been designed and what they just instinctually do, the way God created them. We, on the other hand, have free will, and we decide whether or not we're going to submit or whether we're going to follow or whether we're going to go along or not. And to get a whole lot of people to be united in common purpose and plans and work is a very difficult thing to do. When I used to run a business, I used to jokingly, somewhat, talk about the fact that the business was a benevolent monarchy. Okay? It was my way. You did what I said to do, or you didn't have a job. And that's what businesses do. And if you own a business, that's your right. You get to decide what your business does and doesn't do. And if people don't do what you want it done, you tell them you can't work here. That's the way businesses run. Becoming a preacher, I go from that to this work where I have no authority to tell you, make you do anything. Of course, I've been given lots of responsibilities by God to instruct you in things you ought to do. But it has taught me especially patience that I didn't have running a company. When I ran a company and told people what to do, I expected it done, and I expected it done when I said it was going to be done. I expected it to be done promptly, properly, you know, and if not, when it didn't happen, we had to fix it. Cost us money. That never made me happy. When I was losing money, you know, never happy about that. But, you know, in this work, my job isn't to make you do anything. Because God isn't going to make you do anything. God gave you the choice. And unity is one of those things that we have a choice about. We have a choice whether we're going to put out the effort to have it. Or have a choice whether we're going to endeavor to keep it or whether we don't. Whether we play a part in strengthening the bonds or whether we play a part in weakening them is up to us. God gave you the choice. He's urging you which choice to make, and he says there's consequences for making the wrong ones, but it's still a choice you have to make. It can't be made for you. Otherwise, it's not, as we talked about recently, it's not submission. If it's not a choice of your will, it's not submission. Now, the purpose, as he says in Ephesians 4:11-13, you know, is to come to the unity of the faith. He himself gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God. See, the faith, or the Word of God, eventually lead us all to unity. The fact that we don't have it isn't the faith's fault or God's fault, it's really our fault. It's our weakness. We don't always understand things as we should. We don't always live what we do understand. And so it is our weakness. But we keep pressing on. We keep going with that goal in mind, to the unity of faith. Now, one of the passages that thinking about in the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 11, talks about the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion, the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, if you've been at home sometime and had, you know, a Jehovah Witness come by and give you a little pamphlet, they usually have an image of this very thing. And their image is, this is what heaven on earth is going to be like when God gets rid of all those terrible people and all the good people are left. That's their image is this. But the problem is, I don't think this passage in Isaiah, we're talking about a heaven where we've left earth. It is a figurative language, but he's talking about something that's in my holy mountain. He tells us in Hebrews 12:22, we have come to the holy mountain. You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. We've already done that. This is a passage in Isaiah 11 talking about what happens after the Christ has established peace. He's talking about the lions and lambs all together. Well, obviously, I'm not talking about literally lions and lambs, but figuratively, that there's nobody there to destroy. In some ways, it's a little bit of an image back of the creation in Genesis 1 and 2 before the flood, when animals didn't have a fear of man. Man didn't kill animals for food. And they kind of lived together in peace. After the flood, God says that changed. But he's kind of talking about a peace. Well, you know, there's peace. We don't fear. We have anything to fear. Well, as Christians today, having come to the holy mountain, the living mountain of God, don't we already have that? Don't we have nothing to fear? Isn't that what he tells us, to not be afraid? Nothing can separate us from the love of God. And so he's talking about something where we have this, we don't have to fear about, the wolves and the lions and the lambs. But lions and lambs together, obviously, in the real world, there's a problem, isn't it? Lions will, would eat the lambs or eat any other kind of, pack animal like that. And the lambs are going to be deathly terrified of the wolves or the lions, aren't they? So there's two things that really have to happen for the lions and the lambs to live together. And if I take this, I kind of take the imagery as people. As people, some of us I describe as, some of us are like lions. We're strong. We're more aggressive. We're more, certain people are going to get what they want to get, and if anybody else is in their way, it doesn't matter. They're going to take it. Well, some of us are more like lambs, where we just got to step out of the way for anybody. And it's sometimes hard in a church to bring all the different kinds of personalities in the world, bring them together and create unity. Because the reality is, if you just take, and this, we've got a fairly small group here, but if you took this group, would we all be friends without the church? Probably not. Some of us might. Some of us might run into each other, be friends with one another, but we wouldn't be friends, all of us together, without the church. The church is what brings us together in faith. You probably even have friends that don't belong to the church. Maybe they have more things in common with you than either other people in the church. See, but sometimes we have trouble putting aside all those differences to create unity, because we really are different. And so sometimes overcoming that is very difficult. And one of the couple of passages that talk about this, let me go back. This thing sticks on me sometimes again. So this time you're not seeing it. Flick through all the different slides. But, one of the problems for a lion in personality, and just taking the analogy, lambs are tasty. If you're a lion, you kind of like the way a lamb might taste. Kind of like the way, some of those prey animals taste. But lions like that. So if a lion and a lamb are going to lie down together, lion's going to have to put aside its tendency to eat the lamb. But on the other hand, if you're a lamb, lions are kind of scary. And you don't really want to put yourself out there near them. And we don't want to sometimes, we see people that are intimidating or, forceful. And, you have those, we get those in the church all the time. Different kinds of personality types. I've been in classes, about personality types, applying them in within the church. And this was a generic, this was kind of, you know, open to all kind of religious workers. They identified 15 distinct personality types that you find within any kind of big group. And identified, and there's a couple of them that are very difficult. Very difficult personality types. And you're gonna have to deal with them. But sometimes, a lot of the other personality types can't deal with them. They feel like they get run over and they get squashed and they get hurt and it creates an atmosphere where you don't feel united. You don't feel together. And part of it is we have a trouble sometimes to put away the bad sides of our personality because of what we want. And we have trouble creating that unity together. Come to the examples in Galatians 5:15. What did Paul write to them? He says, "But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another." They were doing it in the first century. Here they are, a church that has the apostles there. You think, wow, they probably have great unity. No, they didn't really. They had exactly the same kinds of problems, even with the apostles there. I mean, think about the concept in the gospel, in the John's letters. He refers to the fact that there were people like Diotrephes who wouldn't allow Apostle John or those who supported him to preach in their church. Could you imagine the somebody who was so strong of will and personality that he wouldn't let an apostle come and preach in the church? The church in the first century had just as many problems as we do. Had just as the same kinds of conflicts, the same kinds of issues. Just a different culture, but the same tendencies, the same temptations, the same conflicts have existed in every culture, in every place where man has been. And so the tendency is for lions and lambs to come together and actually bite and devour. Or 1 Corinthians 3:3 says, "For you are still carnal, for where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men?" Sometimes we just act like we normally act. And the reality is, God didn't call us to act like we normally act and to be just like you normally are. He called you to be more than that, to be like Him. In 2 Corinthians 12:20, he says, I fear lest when I come, I shall not find you such as I wish, and that I shall be found by you such as you do not wish. This is Paul talking to the Corinthians. His second letter to the Corinthians, he writes just a few months before he shows up, and he sends a letter on ahead because he has a couple of fears. One, the collection that they said they would do for the saints in Jerusalem, he's a little bit afraid that they may not have been doing it. So he wants to give them a little warning that I'm going to be there soon. But the second thing is there's still some people there who have not heard the rebukes and have not responded appropriately to the rebukes that he'd sent in his earlier letters. And he's going to have to come and straighten them out. Now that's not going to be pretty. That's not going to be pleasant. And he doesn't want to do it. And so he's being patient and long-suffering to hope that they will change. But if they don't change, he's going to come, you know, use the euphemism of today, knock some heads. He's going to come and he's going to change some things. And some of the people may be out if they don't turn around. But he says, I don't want that. I hope you will change and you don't want to find me like you say I can't be. One of the complaints against Paul was he was real powerful in word, but in presence he was mild and meek. A weak guy. But he's saying, you know, I could show up and be like you don't want me to be. Please, don't make me be that way, is what he's saying. Part of what his letter to the 2 Corinthians is about. What are they being? They're being lambs and lions come together and they're arguing and they're struggling and they're still people. Well, we're always going to have that. If we're bringing people in from the world and we're, you know, baptizing new people and having new Christians, we're always going to be dealing with it, aren't we? It's never going to go away. But we want to be urging one another to make the effort. Keep going. Now, The goodness of unity. He talks about it in Psalm 133, a song of David. And he says, behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. So that's the statement. He says, it is so pleasant and so good. Now I'm sure most of you know that. I'm sure most of you have been in a group, you know, of God's people and gone, you know, man, this is great. This feels great. I feel wonderful with these people. But I'm also sure most of you have been in places where you go, this doesn't feel that great. It doesn't feel that united. It doesn't feel that together. It feels like, something might, you know, set off and go off anytime. Because both those things happen in groups. They happen in churches all the time. And sometimes a church that had one at one time, you know, you add some more people to the mix and a little different. And what do we say? You know, sometimes it only takes one bad apple, right? To change the whole environment. And you can take a church that was great and good and everything felt, you know, boy, everybody felt united and together and going. And a little bit later, and you're thinking, man, what's happened? Something feels wrong. And the reality is sometimes you can't even define it. You don't even know exactly what it is. And you can't even say, well, it's that person's fault. Because you think, well, that person's trying to do the best they can. And it's tough. It is a difficult mix taking 75 different people and personalities, putting them together and say, get along. Which one of you... You have a business. How many of your businesses, you know, you work at a business, how many of those businesses would everybody completely get along and be everything's wonderful and everybody loves one another? Your business is all like that? Any group of people, you could take it anywhere in the world. You're not going to take 75 people and it could be like that without effort. Effort has to be put out in order for that to happen. That's one of the reasons businesses actually... sometimes send all those managers to those kind of, you know, unity building up, you know, weekend things. They're trying to create an atmosphere that makes people more productive. As Christians, when we have this atmosphere, we're also more productive in working for God. That's one of the reasons it's so powerful, that unity. Sometimes, and I remember part of a congregation where, you know, I felt that. I think everybody there felt it. And it just attracted people. I mean, people were coming in and we had opportunities to study and reach out that it's almost like we weren't working for it. Because it is attractive. You know, honey, some things that are pleasant and sweet attracts those, you know, things to come. Well, behold how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. He says it's like the precious oil upon the head, running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the edge of his garments. It is like the dew of Hermon, descending upon the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord commanded the blessing, life forevermore. Now, I'm not sure this pleasantness really reflects us very well. How many of you, when I describe, let's say I took out a nice big thing of oil, and I started pouring it down over your head, and it started running down your hair, and it started running down, you know, your beard, and for men, obviously. And he says, started running down onto your clothes. You're like, oh, wow, this is great. Say, ooh, I got to take a shower. Got to clean this stuff off. But if you lived in a time and place where people don't take showers, and you rarely take baths, oil was one of those things that was also, that was usually scented. We would call it more like perfume. And you would put that upon you so you wouldn't be smelling normal smells of people who haven't showered and bathed, you know, and who are working out in the fields and amongst the animals. See, oil was a very precious thing in the ancient world. It was used for good smells. It was used for, you know, overcoming, you know, the odors of our body and of sweat. And it was used for that. It was a pleasant thing. Just like, you know, the dew of Hermon. And I think if you have the idea, you know, you think about one of those really hot days. And you know, hopefully we'll sometime get again here in Idaho. But we'll have one of those hot days that'll reach over 100. And well, if you're outside, you're going, oh, man, you're sweating. And you just, if you shade and dew, you know, that cool morning dew, doesn't that, it sounds refreshing. That's what he's talking about. That, he's just trying to describe what unity is like and telling us that it's important and it's valuable and it's powerful. Now, the power of unity. One of the places that he tells us about how powerful unity is in Genesis 11, verses 5 through 9. We know the story of the Tower of Babel. He says, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one. And they have all one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. It almost sounds good. If you didn't know the behind the story part, that sounds good at that point. They're all together with one language and they propose to do this. And then nothing's going to stop them. But the problem is, they're all united against the very commandment God gave the descendants of Noah. To not stay together in one place, but to spread out and keep going and, you know, be fruitful and multiply. And they didn't want to do that. They wanted to stay together. And this unity that they had fostered was so powerful, he says, nothing's going to stop them from doing anything they want to do. Of course, except God. But what God does, because one of the things that allowed them to have this unity, he talks about they're all one and they have one language. One of the things we need for unity is communication. We need to be able to talk to one another. We need to be able to talk to one another well. It goes back to the power of the tongue. But he says, so he basically decided, okay, well, you guys are going to do this. You're going to propose to do what I don't want you to do. And you're all united together and power. He's like, okay, well, I'll just make it so you can't talk to one another. And so we get all the different languages of the world. Start the origins there. And he gives them, they can't hear each other. You can't understand one other speech. And so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth. See, the Lord told them to scatter over the face of the whole earth. And they said, no, we don't want to do that. Okay. We'll make you do it against your will then. You see, God's will, he's going to accomplish what he wants to do. Now, he'll either do it with you or without you. So you can either be on his side and be united with him in that purpose, or you can be against him. He's still going to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Our choice is whether we're going to be with him or not. Now, let's go to last one here. In John 17. In John 17, we have what is often referred to as a high priest's prayer. It is Jesus' prayer before, you know, he's going to be arrested and you know, tried and, you know, be crucified. He prays for himself, then he prays for his apostles, and then he prays for all those who will hear the gospel through the apostles. And he says, starting in verse 20 of John 17, he says, I do not pray for these alone. Talking about he just got through praying about the people the men who are with him. He says, I'm not praying for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. So he's praying for you and I. This is a prayer that is specifically about you and me. Very specific prayer by Jesus for you and me. And he tells us some things here, obviously about how important unity and this oneness is, but also the power it has. He says, I'm not praying for just these guys here with me, but I'm praying for all those who will believe in me through their word, that they all may be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. Now, sometimes with some people, you have to actually go through the proof in the scriptures to show that the Father and Jesus and the Holy Spirit are not one. They have different wills. That's why one can submit to the other's will. As they talk about, Jesus didn't do his will. He submitted to the Father's will. Holy Spirit, same thing. So there are three different individuals who are the Godhead. Or they are God. They are Elohim. But they are one. That's why it goes back. One of the reasons why, even to this day, Jews and Muslims look at Christianity as worshiping a plurality of gods is because of the passage in the law that talks about the Lord our God is one. And they take it as a single individual, not as unity. And what God has really told us is that, especially as Jesus is talking about here, when it says God is one, he's meaning God is united. God is one just like he said those people back in Babel were one. They were all united together in purpose. Well, what he tells us is the Godhead is united together in purpose. And they work together perfectly in unison. And he's praying that we will be united together like they are united together. United together in purpose. United together in, you know, our attitudes and our hearts together. And he says that the power that has, he says, that the world may believe that you sent me. And the glory which you gave me I have given them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I and them and you and me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me, and I have loved them as you have loved me. He's praying for our unity, and he tells us that it has the power to influence the world around us. In fact, you think about the concept, since Christianity, and I'm not trying to make a defense for Roman Catholicism, or even Greek Orthodox, you know, the two real Christian religions that existed up till the Reformation of the 1500s. But when the Reformation happened and Christianity splintered into all different kinds of parts, did that convince the world even more so how right we were? Has the world gone, oh wow, there's like 5,000 different types of Christians? That's just proof there's a God. That hasn't proved anything. We have to overcome that because of that disunity that has happened throughout Christianity. Now that's happened because of, you know, the sinfulness of man in these churches doing things that, you know, God didn't want done. But we have to overcome. God says that our unity has an effect. It has a power that can affect the world around us. And we need to have that unity so we could be united. If the goal isn't just to be united, it's to be united with God. Because we could be united, but we could be united like the people of Babel. And we don't want that. We want to be united in God's purpose. So we need not only to be humble and gentle and patient and bearing with one another, using sweet tongues, and to endeavor to keep unity, but we also have to maintain that the purpose is God's. Not mine or yours. It's God's. Are we doing what God wants? Are we pleasing God? We talked about it in Wednesday, in our midweek classes this last week. The passages we were looking at and studying were about, you know, doing those things or figuring out what, you know, pleases God. Remember that, those passages we were kind of looking at and say, you know, doing those things that please God, figuring out what it is the Lord wants. How do we do that? But that's a part of it. That's a part of our unity. Our unity needs to be in what does God want? And are we willing to do it? Are we willing to be like Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6 when he stands before the throne in this whole big scene and they're saying, we don't have anybody to send. And Isaiah's looking around and goes, here I am, send me. Are you willing to be sent to do God's will? That's the unity, and that's what He desires us to do together, is fulfill His will, His desire, to love God, to love each other, and to preach that message of love and the message of the cross to those who don't have it. We're going to end here. Appreciate your thoughts this morning, thinking, and considering what I have said. I hope that it encourages you and urges you to make the effort, because it really is important. It has a power that each one of us does not possess by ourselves. None of us have alone what we have together. And Christ has told us that He gave us all of each other so that we could all do our parts and allow the body of Christ to grow. Don't let your link weaken the chain. Let the rest of us strengthen you so that together we can work for God. We haven't talked about what you need to do to become a Christian, and there may be those here today who are still thinking about it. Considering, are you going to be a Christian? Are you going to decide to follow Him? I know there's a number of people here who need to think about that, who've got to consider it. Some of the young people starting to think, you've heard these messages, I was struck by a thing David was talking about, growing up in the church, and I always because I didn't grow up in the church, and I've always heard the phrase growing up in the church, and I actually think there's a much better phrase: you grew up raised by Christians. You didn't really grow up in the church. One of the misnomers is that you grew up in the church. You didn't. You grew up kind of around the church, showing up with the church, but you weren't really there. You weren't really participating. You weren't really doing it. At some point in your life, though, you have to decide. Got to do more than just show up. Got to be more than just taken by the hand and brought to the building. You got to decide. Am I going to do that? Am I going to follow Him? That's a choice that in fact, I think it's a great blessing to be raised by Christians, even though they were fallible. There isn't a Christian parent anywhere that didn't make mistakes, that didn't do things that, God wouldn't have wanted them to do. But it's still an advantage to have been raised by people who understood what truth was and what goodness was and who Jesus was. That's an advantage. And I hope, as young people, you can learn to understand that advantage, and you can take advantage of it. So someday you might make that choice that says, I will follow Him. I will do. I will please Him with my life, so that it's He that works in me, as Paul tells us. So we're going to have an opportunity, if you're in need, to study, to make that commitment. We'd be glad to hear your confession that you want to follow, to baptize you into Him, that you might be raised up in new life. Be glad to study with you if you have questions. Be glad to help you if you have needs that we can serve. If you're here today and we can serve you in any way, please let us know how, as together we stand and sing.